I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Heart. I'm Caitlin Prest. This is Silent Evidence.
That harsh realization that not even your parents can protect you from something, and how destabilizing that is.
Let the music play, he won't get away, just keep the groove and then he'll come back.
If it's not like physical force, like the boundary crossing, and like, then they'll just trick you, like, you know? Like, I feel like I've been tricked.
So this is the second episode. If you haven't listened to episode one, Not the Right Time, make sure to start there. I'm going to give you a trigger warning. In this series, we are following our friend Tennessee Watson as she grapples with being sexually abused as a kid. In the last episode, we grow up with Tennessee as she comes to terms with what happened, figures out that it was real, it was a big deal, and gets up the courage to tell her dad, Bill. And with Bill in tow, she goes to visit the gym where it happened. This is episode 2, 10-foot pole.
I learned the topography of my new home through my feet. I'm living in New York City now, and every morning I wake up, I walk my dog, and then I go on a run. All the running has made me feel lighter. I like that. I know that my 6-mile run burned 700 calories. After running, I eat an apple and a spoonful of peanut butter, just enough fuel for the 8-mile bike ride from Brooklyn up and over the bridge to class. I'm taking a course in sound art, and I settle into a hard plastic chair, take out my graph paper notebook, and start thinking about the recordings I made a month ago. They were with my dad.
It's a little creepy.
You heard some of them in the last episode. I recorded us going to the gym where a grown man fondled my vulva when I was 7.
I think I could come back again. Some other time. Do some sort of weird artistic intervention. I don't know. I think it'd be really hysterical to, like, come back in some crazy-ass leotard, you know, when they're open. Do some weird performance art.
That's right. I said weird performance art. An art project is what brings me face-to-face with Dr. Yousefi.
Okay, you want to do some bouncing?
Hey, I'm Tennessee.
Hey, how are you?
But we're not going there just yet. First, I have to work up the courage. Some of you, like my dad, might be wondering why, upon discovering that the gym where I was molested is still open, am I hellbent on taking care of this myself? And why make weird performance art when I could just call the cops? I assume if I call the cops, the dispatcher would patch me over to Sergeant so-and-so in the SVU. I'd seen Law & Order. I was not the girl that gets help from the Special Victims Unit, a teenage runaway caught up in a sex trafficking ring, chained up in a cold basement in shredded lingerie. Plus, it happened decades ago, and there's no evidence. So, the Sarge might take my call and be like, lady, that was 25 years ago. How do you plan on proving that? He touched your labia? I don't even know what that is. So there's the possibility of calling up and being dissed because my victim status isn't acute enough or current enough. But there's also the possibility of the cops taking action on my behalf, but for the wrong reasons. I didn't want to see this story spin out of control in a way that pits Dr. Yousefi and me against each other, the vengeful victim and the diabolical offender. What I want is to have a conversation about why this happens. Not why Dr. Yousefi did this to me, but why in general have I lived my whole life feeling like this is only a big deal to me. Art is how I'll be in control of my healing. It's how I'll create evidence that I do sometimes stick up for myself.
We seldom choose disclosure. Not right away.
I'm gonna read today.
There's a performance piece where I get naked and change leotards over and over.
Sexual encounters, something would trigger this memory.
And there is an interactive installation in a tent that's made out of spandex and leotards.
Started dancing and love put us into a groove.
Some of these projects are ridiculous, but healing does start to happen as I practice feeling less ashamed about asking people to listen. People are generally receptive. It makes me feel ready to start scheming on how to come face to face with Dr. Yousefi. I've been reluctant to admit the power of Dr. Yousefi's actions. Maybe my chubby childhood and my fear of the dark have nothing to do with him. One afternoon in November, I Googled trauma and ended up on a Wikipedia page on childhood sexual abuse. I learned that the impacts are hard to see. It shows up as anxiety, depression, addiction, overeating, eating disorders, attention disorders, sleep disorders, suicide. I think about the fact that I know exactly how many calories the cream in my coffee has, 10. My apple and peanut butter, 170. My run, minus 700. That Google search gave me permission to point the finger. It makes me angry. It makes me want to be confrontational. In my next scheme, I decide to stage a silent sit-in at the gym. We'd be in the way of the classes, so he'd have to call the cops to have us removed. When we refused to leave private property, we'd be arrested and charged with trespassing. When asked why we'd done what we'd done, we'd remain silent, hopefully forcing the authorities to ask Dr. Yousefi why we were there. I enlist the support of my friends and my dad. Here's me talking to Bill about the plan.
So, you know, I'm just trying to figure out, like, how do I do it a different way? I'm trying, my whole mission is to, like, do it a different way, you know?
Well, two things come into this. Is the one thing everybody says is your daughter in therapy? And I go, I don't have a clue. I think so, but I'm not sure. Should have asked her that, probably.
I'm not in therapy. This is like...
Well, you said you've gone to therapy. You like therapy, you know.
I've never been to therapy, Bill. I went one time.
Well, why do you recommend it for me?
It doesn't... Because I think it is a good idea.
It is a good idea. So...
I mean, it's not that I don't... It's not that I'm not doing it because I don't think it's a good idea. I'm not doing it because, like... I have the crappiest fucking health insurance on earth because it takes a lot of time because you go and you talk to one person and you have to figure out whether you like them or not. I mean, it's a whole fucking process.
Same reason I don't do it. So I understand that completely.
Yeah.
Bill and I go on deliberating about therapy and the plan, and eventually he convinces me that the plan is a little too abstract and a little too aggressive. He reminds me that I set out to not be divisive. It backs Yousefi into a corner. He points out that we can't guarantee that anyone will understand we're trespassing Yousefi's gym because he trespassed me. So in my next scheme, I try to make things really clear. I decide to call Dr. Yousefi, tell him I'm a journalist, and ask to do an interview.
To listen to your messages, press 1. First voice message. Sent yesterday at 3:05 p.m.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Yousefi returning your call. I have a note in front of me. Mrs. Watson called. She's a former student and like to have an appointment for interview. So I have a story about injury.
In addition to being a gymnastics coach, I read on his website that he works with kids with developmental challenges. He focuses on helping them adapt to what's blocking a more functional integration of body and mind.
If that's correct, give me a call in my cell phone. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day.
I haven't heard his voice since I was 7, and now he's in my phone. He sounds nice. So many things I'm dying to ask him. Why did you think it was okay to touch me like that? What set you up to think it was okay? Like, what did you see? What did you hear? Like, what else was happening that made you think that, like, this was a thing that grown men do? Were you abused? Was there some reason that you felt vulnerable? Did you think I was coming on to you? If my leotard wasn't too big and you hadn't been able to see my vagina, like, was that tempting? Would you not have touched me? Was my leotard actually too big? Did you bank on the fact that I would stay silent? Did you think I might say something, but it didn't matter because you knew I'd never be able to prove it? What I want the most is to face him and to not feel afraid. In the guise of a radio interview, a thing that I've done 1,000 times, the rules of engagement are determined by me. There's a pretext to this conversation that feels safe. I enlist the help of my friend Sam. She's an EMT and sailor, not adverse to crisis. A good person to have around in case things don't go according to plan. We're on the same drive, Route 66. I remember as a kid I would get car sick coming out here. I now know that I can ease my nerves if I focus on my breath.
Breathe.
Yeah, I can't be nervous because, like, I don't want him to pick up on that.
Yeah. Just breathe. Yeah. Like, when you get in there, sit down. Don't rush yourself. You have plenty of time. Set your shit out. Sit down. Get comfortable. There's no one rushing you.
Yeah. And, like, what happens will happen.
Yeah.
And just go with the flow.
Right.
Cool.
You want a hug?
Yeah. Hug it out. Okay. See you later, dude.
I'll be right here.
Just inside the door, there's a mom leafing through an ancient issue of Marie Claire. The gym stretches out behind the waiting area. I can see a mini trampoline, floor mats, and I can see him.
Okay. Bye-bye. Just get your shoes on.
Hey, I'm Tennessee.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Fine, come on in.
Okay.
Hold on one second.
Okay.
Come on in.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, you said you want to record everything.
Yeah.
All right.
Because I do, I'm a radio producer, so.
Mm-hmm.
And I might.
When I got a note.
Yeah.
And then said, Watson, because I had a
You probably
student.
Knew me as Tenny, though. That might have been what you
Jenny Watson.
Tenny
Watson, probably.
Yeah.
Years ago. And her father was the colonel, an army colonel. And then mom was a great athlete.
Oh, really?
I thought the first, but the sound was not...
This whole Jenny, not Tenny, throws me a bit. And he knew my dad well enough to know he wasn't a colonel.
Yeah. Are you going to sit there? No. My dad's not a colonel.
Yes. I just noticed the other different ones. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
All right.
A bead of sweat departs my armpit and rolls straight down my rib cage. I wonder if he's testing me. I know that sweat is my body's autonomic response to danger. My nervous system is warming me up in case I have to run for my life. But I'm not going to get up because I don't want him to think I'm scared. So I stick to the plan as I internally assess the possibility of asking him what I really want to know.
Based on your introduction, right now I'm having wrist problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was like 10, 12, I started to do gymnastics. Lots of abusive exercises. I never ever realized those impact one day this is going to stay in my system. And then when I'm 50s and 60s, and they say, knock the door, say, well, you remember what you did to your wrist?
Within the first 2 minutes of our conversation, abuse comes up. Granted, he's talking about the damaging things we do to our bodies when we're too young to process the implications of our actions, while I'm thinking about the damaging things other people do to our spirits because we're too young to process the implications of their actions.
Or your shoulder.
Okay, hold on, I need to shift a little closer to you because it's like stretching out over the table. Do you mind if I move this?
I tuck my knee under my butt, prop my elbow on his desk, and lean over to get my audio recorder closer to his mouth.
So if there are certain patterns that are set from the time that you're a kid, and then as an adult, can you like rework yourself so that you're more integrated and physically function better?
It depends on how much fear you created. If you psychologically scarred by those injuries, it's so difficult to go back to the same, like someone from diving, for instance, height involved, speed involved, for instance. Like on the high bar, giant has lots of speed, right?
Thank you cards and art from kids adorn the walls. And I'm wondering whether we're both having subtextual conversations, or if it's just me. Do we both know what happened, or does he really not remember? I let myself read everything he's saying as though it's referencing our shared history somehow.
If they're 20, 24, they cannot. If they, specifically they get injured, they quit, just stop. Just stop doing it.
The conversation turns to failure. He says the only way to fail is to quit. And a lot of kids quit when things get hard.
It's so hard, Mom. I don't want to do it. One and nag. Mommy's mom say, okay, don't worry about it. I'll take you to swimming. That's done. Okay, that child is going to be away. So she's learning to quit.
This is my opportunity to tell him why I walked away from gymnastics.
Right.
And I quit. But I remember certain things.
Like what?
This slow, deliberate question means something to me. I'm on the edge of saying what I really remember.
The stand up, roll back to shoulder stand.
Shoulder stand
up.
But I don't. And then he says some philosophical BS to make me feel like less of a quitter.
When we go to a cul-de-sac of life, we turn around, right? This is exactly what we have to do. We cannot say, well, God, this is dead end here. Okay, we stay here. It's dead end. We don't never ever do that. We turn around, come back. U-turn, that was a U-turn is.
It's like he's telling me to just accept that he fucked up and move on. I could do that if it wasn't for all these kids I see streaming in and out of his gym. I let him ramble on.
His change is always ongoing. During this conversation, Ms. Watson with me, a lot of things changed. Many things changed during this hour conversation. So change is always is part of our human gene, human evolution. I'm 1 hour older than an hour ago. So my age, my psychology, I'm hungry now. And anyways, I have to go.
And then bam, he's done. Conversation is over.
So anyways, so things changing. Good luck, and I hope this conversation useful for kids and people listening to it.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello.
Hi.
That was so fucking weird.
I spend the next couple months trying to cut together an audio piece from the recordings with my dad and Dr. Yousefi. But all I'm doing is producing more memories of me being silent, avoiding it, being afraid of it.
Like what?
The stand up, roll back the shoulder stand.
I've been running every day, but I don't feel light. I do the master cleanse. Daily dose of water with lemon, cayenne, splash of maple syrup. It's recommended to drink 8 to 10 glasses a day.
800 calories.
I drink 6.
600 calories.
12 days. Day 1. Day 2. Day 3.
So much.
It's a pleasure.
Day 4.
Come on.
Day 5. Day 6. Day 7. 12 days. Then a strict, raw diet. So I have this recording from my abuser where we vaguely agree that something from your past can affect you for life in ways that are hard to see. I'm doing things my way, but what the fuck am I doing? I'm using all this art making to hold this shit at the end of a 10-foot pole. I've never been to therapy. I've never even called a crisis helpline. I've never explicitly asked my dad to help me figure out what to do, or anyone for that matter. I've never even had a heart-to-heart with another survivor who's dealt with it. And while I'm in my intellectual art bubble doing my fake interviews, their kids stretching and playing under Dr. Yousefi's care, a new crop of developmentally challenged kids streaming in and out of his gym. And that's troubling. But right now, I'm done trying to deal with this. June rolls around and I get a call from Sam, the sailor and EMT. She was there in the parking lot when I went to see Dr. Yousefi. And now, she's luring me to Maine with promises of a job on a sailboat. And that summer, working on that blessed boat, the Francis, opened me up to the one thing that always restores my faith in humanity. Love.
Like, do you remember, like, one of the first times that you knew that she liked you back?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she bought me a beer, like, pretty much immediately upon arriving at this dance party. Because I was also tall and maybe, like, I had some funny clothes on or something. We danced together to Taylor Swift's song. And then that was the first time we touched. No, sorry. It was Carly Rae Jepsen. Not Taylor Swift. My bad. Yeah, I guess we were sort of, I wouldn't say grinding, I wouldn't say American grind, but we were definitely, like, you know, busting out the moves. We went down to the pier, and she had shown me her dead baby tooth that she has, which was, you know, pretty big turn on to kiss a lady when she's got a rotten tooth up front. So yeah, a grown-up tooth never came in there. It's like sort of sideways, I guess, up top. And if you keep a baby tooth long enough, I guess it just dies in your head and like turns a little black, and apparently catches food pretty frequently, so she has to clean it out kind of all the time with various, like, receipt corners and credit cards and whatever else she has on hand, so it doesn't rot even further and stink.
The tall boy that falls in love with Tennessee, is named Yeshe Parks. And Yeshe's support is just what Tennessee needed to take a step back and look at things in a new way. Next week.
Good morning, Sergeant Brown. My name is Tennessee Watson, and I'm calling to report a crime. So, yeah, if you could give me a call back, that would be great.
A court case. Silent Evidence is produced by me and Tennessee Watson. Editing by Sharon Mashihi. Help, as always, from the Heart team, Mitra Kaboli and Samara Brieger. So many more ears were lent to this piece. They say it takes a village to raise a child, and this piece definitely took a village. Pike, Sarah, Alan, Ida, Audrey, Brendan, Martina, and many, 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 many more that I'm probably forgetting. Please take this conversation up on Twitter. Use the hashtag Silent Evidence Project. The series has its own special website, silentevidenceproject.org, and there you can find out more about child sexual abuse and access all of the things that you ever wanted to know and have all the questions that are burning inside of you answered by really smart people who have thought and written about this, including Tennessee Watson. We will most definitely link to that on our website. Remember, we're releasing episodes weekly for the duration of this series. This project was made possible with funding from the IWMF, Howard Buffett Fund for Women Journalists. Thanks, as always, to MailChimp and the Knight Foundation for supporting Radiotopia shows.
But I think she wants to get a golden tooth, though. I support silver teeth, but it's all right. It's cool.
Radiotopia. From Pete.